Over the past few years, it's been a pleasure getting to know Chris Stedman. As a young atheist interfaith activist, he has in many ways blazed an original trail in the field of interreligious dialogue. Chris is the author of a terrific memoir, Faithiest: How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious, and he serves as the assistant humanist chaplain at Harvard, which is why, when recent debates regarding the possibility of including humanist chaplains in the U.S. Armed Forces caused a torrent of outrage and blind ignorance, I knew we needed to talk to Chris again. So, Chris Stedman, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
That's good. It is for you, too. Chris, there have been so many hostile and hateful reactions to the very idea of a humanist chaplaincy within the military. I'm not even sure where to begin this interview, but clearly we need to just explain why this is a valid concept. So why don't you start there and describe also a little bit about your work in the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard?
Sure. Well, let me just begin by saying that I understand the confusion. I have a harder time understanding the hate and the vitriol, but I definitely understand the confusion around the term chaplain. For many people, the word chaplain clearly has religious connotations, and more often than not, those connotations are actually explicitly Christian. But like many words, the definition of chaplain has evolved over time. If you look at the history of chaplains in the military, for example, initially only Christians could serve as chaplains. Then, not long after that, Jewish people could serve as well. But it would be another almost 150 years before there was the first Muslim chaplain in the U.S. Armed Forces. So though the term chaplain may have Christian connotations, it has evolved. If you look at Harvard, for example, where I currently work, you'll find nearly 40 chaplains that represent a wide array of religious and philosophical traditions and communities, from atheism and humanism to Swedenborgianism and Zoroastrianism. It really runs the gamut. And you know, for many of the communities that have a chaplain at Harvard, the title of chaplain has little to no historical precedent whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But as a group, we collectively work to expand this definition because we see the role of chaplain as meeting a need of these diverse communities. And, you know, personally speaking, and this is something I've said and written about, you know, I don't feel all that attached to the title of chaplain. I mean, I really think of myself in many ways as a community organizer and as a care provider, as a practitioner. Mm-hmm. If you want to call that a chaplain, that's fine. If you don't, that's okay. But, you know, I do think that it is an important conversation to have because, you know, when the standard term used for somebody who is a community care practitioner, provider, is chaplain in a given context, then I think that term should be applied across the board. I mean, it's a similar, I have a similar feeling about the debate over whether legally recognized same-sex unions, partnerships, should be called marriages or civil unions. I mean, mm-hmm. I think when one term is the standard, is normative, and certain groups of people aren't given access to that term, especially when it's a group that's been historically marginalized, like many mm-hmm. non-religious and atheists have been, then there's a problem when only certain people have access to the term.
Yeah.
But, you know, that whole conversation about language and the definitions of the term, it's interesting to me, but what's more interesting to me is the conversation about what humanist chaplains actually do, what right. function they play, how they serve people.
Well, I want to go there in just a second, but I also sadly have to recognize that some people have trouble with the word chaplain, other people have trouble with the word atheist, and who an atheist is. Some people who ought to know better grasp atheism as nothing more than not believing in anything.
Mm-hmm.
What's it going to take for people to start to understand, or maybe even first just want to understand, the word atheist and what that means?
Well, I think that this is definitely connected to the bridge-building, relationship-building work between atheists and other non-religious people and religious believers that you and I have discussed before. I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about who atheists are, what they do and do not believe, and a lot of these misconceptions originate in long-standing anti-atheist bias, but I think one thing that atheists and humanists can do and are doing now is put ourselves out into the public square, mm-hmm. and introduce ourselves as full individuals representing, many different beliefs and convictions. And this is why, you know, I am an atheist and I'm proud to be an atheist. It's not something I'm ashamed of. It's not something I shy away from. And I think that, you know, I use the term atheist a lot because I think it's important to own it and destigmatize it. But I'm also a humanist, and that's something that I really put at the forefront of my interactions with others because, you know, I am an atheist, but there are also many things that I believe in, things that I stand for, values that I hold, and humanism is a worldview, it's a progressive philosophy of life that encompasses the values that I hold, and I think that atheists and humanists need to build these kinds of relationships with religious believers where we have an opportunity to introduce ourselves as full human beings and to tell the story of what it means to be a humanist who believes in the possibility of collaboration, who believes in the potential of humanity to do good. I mean, I think, you know, as an atheist, I believe that there's probably no God and that there's probably no afterlife. And thus, I put my focus on the here and now. And I think that if there are no divine or supernatural forces that are going to intervene in human affairs and solve our problems for us, then it's up to human beings, religious and non-religious, to work together to build that the kind of world that we want to see, to respond to the human problems that we face. And I think that that is a story, and that is a set of ideas that is very consistent with a lot of the values and aspirations of many religious people. And I think mm-hmm. that is a place where common ground can be found and where we can begin to challenge some of the longstanding systemic biases against atheists and humanists.
Boy, that's also just a terrific statement about how you incorporate your identity and then what comes from that. And it does build a bridge for the next question that I want to ask because many people are asking the question. If you are serving as a chaplain, whether at Harvard or if in the military, probably even a broader group of people than those at Harvard, how do you as an atheist or a humanist chaplain deal with people in your chaplaincy work if some of them are people of faith?
Sure. Well, my job does not entail preaching, if you will. Mm-hmm. It does entail consciousness raising. So you might call that preaching mm-hmm. if you want it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do is help. I try to communicate what humanism is and make information readily available. And this is something that chaplains can do in the military that, for example, psychologists cannot. And that's one of the common arguments that we hear is, you know, why do non-religious people in the military need chaplains? They can just go visit a psychologist, which is, I think, a really silly argument because it kind of implies that some religious people don't visit both chaplains and psychologists. And we could talk about this more later, but psychologists and chaplains do function in very different ways. And one of those mm-hmm. differences is chaplains can actually go out and look for members of their own community. We can seek them out and just let them know that we're available, which is something psychologists do not do. And so, you know, I don't have an agenda when I'm working with someone, whether they're religious or non-religious, to sort of move them one direction or the other. My job is to meet people where they are and help them identify resources and help them listen to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just think you know, the worry that humanist chaplains are going to infiltrate the military and try to deconvert people is a rather silly one. It's not a goal that I have, and certainly, you know, my job as a chaplain is about providing care for those who want it. But in the same way that a Christian would probably prefer, many Christians would probably prefer a Christian chaplain over a Muslim or a Jewish chaplain, they prefer to sit down with someone who they feel sort of speaks the same language, believes similar things. I think that non-religious people should have the opportunity to have that resource as well. Now, does that mean that there are non-religious people in the military who aren't currently meeting with a religious chaplain and getting something from that interaction? Of course, I'm sure that that happens. But for those who would prefer to sit down with someone who they feel is representative of what they believe, I think that option should be available.
Yeah. Chris, I know you've been doing a lot of traveling and speaking. As you talk to people about interfaith issues from a humanist perspective, are there some themes that you find coming up again and again? I guess I'm wanting to ask, what are you learning about the opportunities and challenges of the kind of dialogue that you're working so hard to promote?
Well, I'm learning a lot. And honestly, I mean, I have to say my favorite thing about publishing a book and then getting to sort of go out there and talk with people about it is how much I learn. And, you know, that is something that I even talk about in the book. You know, I wrote it because I wanted to contribute to a discussion, but I really see it as just one step in a much longer process. And so I've been very fortunate since the book's come out to get to speak with people and learn from them. And one of the things that I really see emerging is that interfaith work that brings together people who are of different religious backgrounds, but have sort of similar values or might, you know, let's say, for example, people who are of different religious backgrounds, but are, you know, politically progressive and very similar to one another in that sense. That kind of interfaith organizing is valuable, and there is a real need for it in a world in which the loudest voices all rise to the top and the more progressive or moderate voices tend to get drowned out. But I think that there is an increasing desire for and hunger for conversation with people who are really, you know, who fundamentally disagree with you on very significant issues. You know, I've had the opportunity to speak at some evangelical Christian colleges where, were I a student, I would, you know, I could potentially be kicked out for being gay or for being an atheist. I've had an opportunity to speak at a conference co-sponsored by Brigham Young University. I mean, I've had, you know, several chances to step into environments where I am very clearly the other and where I know going in that there is not going to be consensus on some issues that are very important to me. And honestly, those conversations have been perhaps the most fruitful of any that I've had. Yeah. And so I am seeing more and more that there's a great interest in moving beyond simply, you know, talking to people who have different worldviews but are on a similar page politically, and really having a different kind of conversation between communities that have historically been really opposed to one another. And so that's something that I'm learning a lot more about, and I'm eager to support and see more development in that area.
Chris Stedman is the assistant humanist chaplain at Harvard University and the author of the memoir, Faithiest, How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious. And I understand, Chris, that the paperback edition of that will be out in October, right?
That's right, yeah.
Chris, it's always a pleasure to have you with us on State of Belief Radio. I just have to tell you, I always resent the fact that you wrote your autobiography at 25. I'm still trying to write one, but I want to talk more next time about what you're doing next, and I know that it could be almost anything, but...
Well, first of all, you better write it, because I will be among the first to buy it and read it. And second of all, thanks again for having me on, and I'm really looking forward to the next time we get to